Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Achtung, Achtung, welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. We're invading your weekends. It's the very first Sunday descent upon your weekend time with me, Al Murray, and James Holland, of course, in his beautiful book-lined library man cave with an SMLE in the background. James, how are you?
Yeah, I'm good, thank you. Al, how are you?
Great. Yeah, really good.
Absolutely brilliant.
I've never felt better during this pandemic.
You're looking very healthy and well.
So, James, who are we joined by today?
Well, I've got to admit, this is a good one for me because we've got Annabel Venning, and Annabel is a neighbour of mine, but also one of my greatest mates, and of course is married to that reprobate Guy Walters.
The evil hunter himself.
The evil hunter himself, exactly. But Annabel is a writer in her own right, an historian. And wrote a fabulous book, which I was lucky enough to read in manuscript form, and I really, really loved it. It's very, very interesting. And we just thought, because, and it's To War With the Walkers, which is basically about her family, her extraordinary family, her grandfather and her uncles and great uncles and great aunts, and what they got up to in the war. And boy, did they all have an amazing war. I mean, they were all over the place, but particularly in the Far East, but also involved in the Blitz. There was nurses, there's doctor, there's decorated heroes in Burma and all the rest of it. So it's an amazing story. And we thought, well, since we're starting this new kind of sort of family orientated podcast for Sundays, what could be better than talking to Annabel, who's actually done it, who's done that whole ancestry thing, looked into a family and researched it properly and actually ended up with a fine book at the end of it.
Thank you.
Well, welcome to We Have Ways. So, Annabel, when you're, because my family, I know fragments of my family's Second World War history, and we've done some of it on the program because my father's researched some of it. Where do you start? Because the thing I know from my family's experience is there are the stories that your great aunt has about what happened, and for instance, to her brother, my grandfather James, there's her story about what happened and the received view she had. And then, of course, there's something completely different, which is when you nudge into it at all, and then you get further into it, and it can often be the complete reverse of what you thought you know. So where do you begin?
Yes, it is exactly as you say. I started with talking to my great aunt Ruth, who was the youngest of the six siblings. So my grandfather, Walter, had three brothers and two sisters. And my grandfather died in 2001, but he sort of mentioned things about his war, you know, along the way. He wasn't one of those people who didn't want to talk about the war. He did quite like to talk about the war. So I was aware of various stories about his war, but I'd never really questioned him that closely. And then I started talking to Aunt Ruth, who was in her late 80s by then. And she sort of, you know, she had a couple of stories about her time as a nurse in the Blitz. And, you know, as soon as she started talking, I was completely blown away because, you know, it was incredibly dramatic. And originally I was just going to focus on her, and then the more she talked about, she sort of mentioned in passing, oh, and, you know, and that was when my brother Peter was a prisoner of war. Oh, and that was when, you know, Walter was in Burma. And I realised that it had to be the six of them. So then I sort of used her stories as a jumping off point. But as you say, you know, what she remembered and what family myth has passed down doesn't always match up. So I was prepared to have things slightly turned on their head. But actually, her memory was really good. And she was quite a dry, low-key sort of person. She didn't, you know, she wasn't given to exaggeration. Everything she told me, I was able to check out through the archives. And although she often got the chronology wrong, it was 70 years ago, she, you know, broadly write about all the events she mentioned. So yeah, Ruth's
stories. So the essence is right. The essence is right, even if the detail isn't.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was a series of interviews with her, recording her, that were my jumping off point. But then also there were, you know, photo albums from my grandparents' time in India, and my grandfather had a book written about him, a biography by the war correspondent Tom Pocock. So that was a great foundation. And he'd also written his own memoir towards the end of his life, which had, you know, slightly different recollections in that hadn't made it into Tom Pocock's book. And then it was, you know, a case of really ferreting out what else I could from all their children. So I went, you know, around the country talking to my second cousins, who most of whom I hadn't really met before, and just asking what stories their parents had told them about the war. And again, checking them out from whatever sources I could find. There were a few letters, sadly not very many, but yeah, there were photo albums, and with the ones who were in the army, they had records, and Ruth's nursing record got that from the London Metropolitan Archives. So, you know, the more you know, the more you can sort of unravel.
So there's quite a lot of basic sleuthing to be done, really, to sort of piece together the paper record.
Yeah.
And then you have to fill in the stuff that isn't on paper, don't you? I suppose that's the hard part, really, isn't it? Because after all, you can say where someone was on a certain date, but what then happens, and again, the order they remember it in. Because, I mean, yes. James and I often talk about on this, when you get a veteran on, or when you interview a veteran, and you know they're, unfortunately, what they're saying doesn't match up with what you think you know and all that. And it's quite tricky because you can't contradict them.
Yes, no, that is really hard, I agree. And there were things that I couldn't... say, for example, with Peter, one of the brothers who was a prisoner of war on the death railway, he told his family various stories, but he hadn't written anything down. He hadn't recorded anything. I went out to Thailand and Burma and saw where he'd been held and so on. And he did have a liberation questionnaire which told what camps he was in. But to get a better picture of what conditions were like in the camps, you know, I had to go to other people's diaries and, you know, find out who was at the such and such camp and such time, and go to their diaries in the Imperial War Museum, or recordings that they'd made for the Imperial War Museum, or self-published memoirs, and, you know, discover what the conditions were like there when Peter was there. And so when he described being, you know, beaten at such and such camp, I would then be able to find
other accounts of
exactly
that happening.
Exactly, yeah, yeah. Yeah. And in the sort of affidavits from the war crimes afterwards.
So take us through it. So Peter was which regiment was he in? So he's in 14th Army and was captured.
Well, he was in the first 8th Punjab.
Right.
So he was not a regular soldier. So the two regular soldiers were Edward, who was the oldest, and Walter. And they both joined...
Walter's your grandfather, isn't he?
Walter's my grandfather, exactly. And they both joined the Indian Army, you know, straight out, well, school, then Sandhurst, then the Indian Army. So they were both serving in India in the 30s. And Peter was a tea planter in India, in Assam. So three brothers were in India. But ironically, it was Peter that first fought against Japanese, while Walter was fighting on the Northwest frontier, and Edward was sort of in staff jobs, desperate to get involved in the action.
Yeah, because that's really interesting. I mean, that's really interesting, isn't it? Because people forget that while the war against Japan, you know, all the kind of normal kind of empire policing stuff that you have to be doing against the sort of wazzes on the Northwest frontier is still going on.
Exactly.
I mean, my uncle joined the Indian Army in 1944, and he was posted out to India. And he ended up on the Northwest frontier, not in Burma. I mean, eventually in 1945, he went to Burma, but he was only after right at the very end of the war, and he never saw any action there. But you know, he was in a mountain artillery unit in the Northwest frontier in 1945.
Yes.
Because that's all still ticking over, isn't it?
Essentially, exactly. Yeah.
And also, what are the Soviets going to do after the war is obviously a question that starts creeping in the last couple of years, isn't it? Because that's we're back into the great game and all that sort of stuff, aren't we, in that part of the world?
Exactly.
So Peter's a plantation owner. You've got Walter and Edward,
well,
a regular worker army.
Yeah, he's just a manager on a tea plantation. Manager, yeah. Yeah. So Walter and Edward are in the regular army. The fourth brother, Harold, is learning to be a doctor at St. Thomas's Hospital in London. There's an older sister, Beatrice, who's a model, mannequin, as they were called, for Norman Hartnell in London, and kind of a girl about town, not getting involved in any war work to start with. And then Ruth, the youngest, she was engaged at the beginning of the war, but her fiancé was in Borneo. And she, because they were going to get married in 1940, which then obviously couldn't happen. So she then joined St. Thomas's as well as a nurse. So she was training as a nurse in 1939. So 1940, you've got three of them in London when the Blitz begins, and the other three in India. And then Peter, by 1941, is posted to Malaya, and he joined the 1st 8th Punjabs because he wanted to serve with his older brother Edward. But pretty much as soon as Peter arrived in Malaya, Edward was posted back to India for a staff job, so they never actually served together. And Peter was, as I say, the first to see action against the Japanese when the Japanese invaded.
And gets captured.
Eventually, yes. So he fought all the way down that horrific retreat, all the way down Malaya. And his regiment, the 1st 8th Punjabs, had a really tough time of it. They fought all the sort of, really grim battles down the Malayan Peninsula. And in fact, he was the only British officer. There were also Indian officers, but he was the only British officer to survive all the way, to carry on all the way down. The others killed, the very first battle, his CO and second in command were killed. And some of the other officers went off to other places. But Peter carried on all the way down, and he was in Singapore, fighting to the last when they surrendered.
Yeah, amazing. And ends up on the Thai-Burma Railway.
Yeah. Yeah, had a horrific time, and his widow, and she was a great interviewee because he married twice. So his second wife is still alive and quite a bit younger than him. And she told me about how he suffered after the war from his injuries, his mental and physical injuries. So she said there wasn't an inch on his back between scars from the beatings that he had while he was in the railway.
And also, you see you've got pictures in your book of him, and it's quite interesting, isn't it? Because, at the start of the war, he's sort of young and fresh-faced and got all his hair and all the rest of it. And by the end of it, he's gaunt and, his hair's receding and, he just looks 10 years older than he is.
Yeah, absolutely. 15. He looks like he's aged about 15 years, in the space of 3 years.
I'd love to sort of talk more about what they got up to, but before that, let's just get to the sort of the process of it. So, I mean, you're talking about archives and going and visiting places and looking at the Imperial War Museum and stuff. But for those who haven't done archival research, how does one get to Kew? How do you find out about how do you get your aunt's, great aunt's nursing details? I mean, where do you go, and how much can you do just sort of sitting on your ass in your office, kind of twiddling around on the computer and Google and stuff? And how much do you actually have to get off your ass and then sort of go up to London or wherever?
Yeah, a bit of both. So sites like Ancestry and Find My Past were really great for dates. So,
Ruth, okay, that's interesting.
Yeah, so Ruth would say, John, that was her fiancé, went out to Sarawak, in 1930-something. And I would then be able to look at the passenger records on the ships and search by name and see that, he did depart from Southampton on...
No way. And that's on Ancestry.
It was on either... And I think it's on Find My Past, actually. Have, I'm looking at it on the wall because I got notes up on my wall. The date that he arrives back in Liverpool in... 7th of June 1942 that's from Find My Past. He, you can see his journey back from, he'd got, he'd, it's a long story, but he was shot down in the, over the Timor Sea, rescued, got to Australia, went back to Britain to join up via Lagos. And that journey from Australia to back to Britain was, you know, documented because it, well, the passenger lists are all available on Find My Past.
And so you can join that up fairly easily. So you look, you can find out which ship it is, you can find out how many funnels it is, you can find out what the, what it cost, what class they travelled, and start to paint a picture out of that, essentially, can't you?
Yes, I mean, I didn't go into that level of detail for that particular journey.
No, but you know what, you know, yes, what I mean? As exactly. An example, that, yeah. That's what that offers you.
Yes, and you can find out that actually later that ship got torpedoed, you know, yeah. off the African coast. And yeah. So, yeah, so there's a tremendous amount you can do sitting on your ass to nail down the dates. And also there's amazing newspaper archives online. So there's the British Newspaper Archive that has lots and lots of local papers uploaded, and you subscribe to that. And you can read, you know, accounts of what was happening in the war, because that was all covered in local papers. I could read the account of when Peter came back from the war in 1945, there were accounts in the local paper. So they, the family, the Walker family, lived in Tiverton in Devon through the 1930s, 20s and 30s. But by the end of the war, my great grandparents had moved to Surrey. And so I found an account in the Surrey Advertiser. Captain and Mrs. Walker welcomed their son Peter back from the prisoner of war camp. You know, delighted to say that Lieutenant Walker had survived. And within that same report, you'd have other families in Surrey who'd only got one of their two sons back. One of them had survived the death railway and the other had died in a camp further up the railway. Somebody else was still waiting. And, you know, also in May 1945, when you had reports of everyone coming, you know, VE Day and everyone celebrating, again, you had very poignantly these reports in local papers of people who were still waiting to hear whether their sons were alive. In Burma.
Amazing.
So local papers were a great source. There's also Australian papers online. And so
yes, I've used those in the past.
Yeah, that's really good. I think it's called Trove. And through the Australian papers, I was able to find the account. So Ruth, Aunt Ruth had told me this incredible story of how John Fisher, her fiancé, before the war, had gone back to Sarawak before the war began. They, you know, got engaged, and she was, you know, kind of preparing her trousseau to go out there and marry him in 1940, and that obviously couldn't happen. But he was in Sarawak in 1941. He'd gone to Australia on leave in December, just, you know, for a holiday. And so he was in Australia when the Japanese invaded Sarawak, which is in North
Borneo.
Just an
amazing strike of luck.
Yeah, I know, really lucky. But he was felt horrified that all his friends were about to be captured by the Japanese. So he and a couple of others who happened to be on leave, a couple of civilians, he was a district officer there, got together, and it was, you know, all sort of officially sanctioned. They got a seaplane and they were trying to get to Borneo to, you know, rescue who they could. And this was as the Japanese were, you know, progressing through Southeast Asia, and their seaplane was shot down in the Timor Sea. The Japanese Zero homed in on them, and suddenly there's a rush tack along the, you know, fuselage, and the pilot is shot, you know, several of the passengers are shot, and the pilot manages to land the seaplane safely. And there's, I think, four survivors, including the captain, and John was one of the survivors. He's, you know, shot through his hand, and he's, you know, got a broken collarbone, and the pilot's also got bullet wounds. And for a while they float around, you know, grabbing at mail sacks that the plane had been carrying. And then they strike out for shore. There's an island in the distance, and they swim for shore. And John had a very sort of self-deprecating way of telling the stories. And, you know, this was passed on to me from Ruth, saying, you know, I managed to get ashore. There was a shark circling me, but, you know, it went away after a while. And
as he's bleeding.
Exactly. And they, you know, they were sort of they were swimming around in the water while the Zero was circling overhead and swooped down, and they thought going to finish them off with, you know, machine guns, but he didn't. He then flew off, and John, apparently, this is from one of the Australian papers, turned to one of the other survivors and said, "Oh, it was jolly sporting of them not to shoot us up in the water."
We're just going to take a short break now. We're talking to Annabel Venning. Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland. We are talking to Annabel Venning about how to look into your family's history.
I've got to say, Annabel, I remember reading the book and thinking I've got massive family wartime experiences envy. That's really, I mean, what I would do to have a family record like this. I mean, I would have just been so you've got newspapers, you've got other sort of various archives, you've got your own family stuff, of course, as well. There's obviously Q, which is for those who don't know, it used to be the Public Records Office, which used to be housed at Somerset House in the centre of London, infamously bombed by the Luftwaffe during the Blitz, which led to the incineration of 2/3 of all the other ranks' records from the First World War and 1/3 of all the officers' records. So they've just gone. So if you've got if you're trying to research one of your family members who was in the First World War, you've either, depending on whether they're an officer or in the ranks, you've got either a kind of 1 in 3 or a 2 in 3 chances of that they still exist. And then moved some years ago to a purpose-built, sort of looks like a sort of modern university campus near Kew Bridge, and you can get the tube to Kew Bridge, or you can drive up or whatever. And it is an incredibly efficient archive, it has to be said. And you go there and, you know, I think you need your passport, don't you, or driving license or something, and a proof of your address and stuff. And you're in and you get your little card and off you go. And it's incredibly easy to use and you can research it all online beforehand. They've got an incredibly good search facility. But I mean, you know, I've done an awful lot of researching of battalion war diaries and that sort of thing and squadrons and stuff. But obviously your great uncles and grandfather were in the Indian Army. So, I mean, can you get the Punjabi regiments and Gurkha regiments online at Kew, or are they in Quetta or something?
I couldn't find very much for the Punjabs, I have to say. But for the Gurkhas, so my grandfather, Walter, joined the 1st 8th Gurkhas in 1933, but he then was transferred to the 4th 8th Gurkhas, which is a war raised battalion. So the 4th 8th Gurkhas, their war diary was available at Kew, so I could go through that, you know, day by day, and it has pretty much hour by hour what they're doing. And, you know, you need to kind of translate military speak a bit, but once you get your head around that, the various abbreviations, again, you can see exactly where they are. And that was fantastic for when I went out to Burma to follow in his footsteps, because I could, you know, go to Milong Baya on, you know, where they were in 5th of March. And
you're standing on that same place. And I always find that,
exactly.
I mean, for me, I mean, you know, Al knows how much I bang on about walking the ground and stuff. But, you know, it is very, very exciting to be there, I think, when you've got you've got someone that you've spoken to, or someone you know, or someone's account or whatever, and he's writing about it or has told you about it, and there you are on exactly the same spot. It's
and, you know, to be exactly where my grandfather stood when he was commanding this battle, and the stories I'd actually heard from his mouth, you know, had taken place right there. He talked about this very brutal battle in the searing heat and, you know, March in Burma. And there I was in the searing heat in March in Burma, standing, you know, at the pagoda where he'd had his headquarters, battalion headquarters. He'd nearly got wiped out by a shell on a couple of occasions. You know, that was amazing. And then later, you know, further down south in Burma, we find this village that he'd written about, the war, the battle that took place there in May 1945. And I wasn't sure I was going to find the village because it wasn't on Google Maps, and all the village names, a lot of the village names in Burma had changed by then. And there's, you know, not a lot of signposts in rural Burma. So it was really touch and go. And then when we got there, we were in a car with a driver who, it was just a saloon car, and we got to the turn off for the village, and this is sort of vertiginous track down a valley side, sort of sandy track, and tried going down with a car and it just wasn't working at all, and the sun was setting, and I was thinking, we're not going to get there. And, you know, you can't just stay overnight somewhere in Burma, Myanmar. In the end, these three guys came along with motorbikes at exactly the right moment and took us down into the valley. This place called Tongdor, which I can't pronounce it, Tongdor, which was where he'd fought this battle in 1945, May 1945, that he remembered so clearly that, you know, only 3 months before he died, he wrote a 7-page account about it for a military magazine. and to be standing there where you had to take these awful decisions of, you know, how, where to bring airstrikes in, whether to send one of his really good friends up a ridge to take the Japanese position that was hammering the guys down in the valley, knowing that this chap who he really liked, this chap called Mike Tidswell, was probably not going to survive, and indeed he didn't. To be there, you know, as the sun was setting, you know, with the village obviously rebuilt, but which had been obliterated, and the villagers talking about, yes, this is where the Japanese, you know, were hammered, were defeated by the British, and realising that, and apparently were the first British to visit there since 1945. And it was a truly amazing moment. But I couldn't have found it without the regimental diaries, without also diaries, books. I was really lucky in that three of Walter's officers wrote and published their own accounts of fighting under him in Burma. So I had his account in their three books as well, and the regimental diaries. And somebody very kindly sent me some maps from the University of Texas that had this village, you know, from the 1950s. Somehow they'd mapped of where this village was, which was, you know, very, very long way off the beaten track. So with a combination of those and a very helpful guide, we were able to, yeah, find this totally out of the way place, and you literally walk in his footsteps. And it was a very spine tingling moment. I wish I'd been able to spend longer there, but, you know, the sun was setting and we had to go.
Did you find that the regiments are helpful and welcoming of this sort of research, or is it just having to do it all yourself?
The one of my greatest sources and helps was the Gurkha Museum, which is in Winchester, and they're incredibly helpful, and it's a really good museum, and they have this lovely room there where, you know, like a proper old-fashioned archive where you can literally see what's on the shelves. And so I was able to find, you know, an unpublished diary from this chap called Tony Brand Crombie, who'd fought under Grandpa, my grandfather, but he'd never published anything. But, you know, there it was on the box file on the shelf, which I just found by kind of, you know, shuffling through, which you can't do in a big archive. You have to know, a bit what you're looking for with
You need a real plan, don't you?
And you have to
turn up and say what you're looking for, rather than kind of follow your nose a bit.
Exactly.
It's less possible to follow your nose at a place like Kew.
Exactly. And same with the Imperial War Museum. Whereas the National Army Museum, it's, you know, they're super helpful there. You can actually go and talk to an archivist and say, this is the sort of thing I'm looking for. And they, you know, they'll point you in the right direction. So there, for example, I was able to find the pre-war diaries of the 1st-8th Punjabs, you know, just discover things about my Uncle Edward, you know, what he was up to in the 1930s before the war, and follow his sort of route from India to Hong Kong, where he got married, back again to India. And then, you know, they had a little bit of information about the 1st-8th Punjabs during the fight through Malaya and Singapore. So that was a great, that, you know, there wasn't a huge amount about them, about the 1st-8th Punjabs, but that was something I could find and really nail down Edward and Peter's movements. So, and then another place, which was, again, you know, trying to get where you can't get it straight from the horse's mouth or straight from, you know, a diary or a letter. Another place was the Royal College of Nursing archives. So again, you know, I was able to go there and kind of browse along the shelves and find diaries which were reproduced in their journal. They've had this fantastic journal that, so the nurses who trained at St Thomas's were known as Nightingales, obviously for Florence Nightingale. I think it was called the Nightingale Gazette, included diaries and obituaries from nurses who'd been there at the same time as Aunt Ruth. So she told me this extraordinary story, which was sort of what started me off on the whole process of how on the second night of the Blitz, she was at St Thomas's. She'd only been nursing for, you know, a year. A bomb hit the hospital in the middle of the night. This is the second night of the Blitz, so it's of early hours of the 9th of September 1940. And she and lots of the other nurses were sleeping in the basement of the nurse's house. And the bomb just came straight through and buried lots of them in the rubble. And she told me about how she was buried under rubble for hours. But going back to the accounts, I could see that it felt like hours, but actually it wasn't hours. It was, you know, probably, you know, 40 minutes or something. She explained how she'd been helped out. She was sort of stuck under this pile of rubble. She was protected by an iron girder that had kind of bent over her and shielded her from the falling rubble. The medical students all formed rescue teams that night and went around trying to find survivors and helped pull several nurses out of the rubble under this building called Gassiot House. So Ruth had described this and how one of her rescuers was actually her brother Harold. And they kind of poked a ladder down and she was able to crawl out, you know, covered in dust, but otherwise unhurt, and went straight back on duty several hours later, you know, wearing a borrowed uniform. And then through the Royal College of Nursing, I was able to find accounts from other nurses. So she'd mentioned that another nurse, a friend of hers called Anne Cooper, had been blown by the blast onto Westminster Bridge. And I, you know, was able to find that in one of these journals, and also accounts by other nurses who'd, you know, crawled out of the rubble covered in dust and with, you know, their feet cut by broken glass. And then the St. Thomas's Hospital had its own journal, its own gazette, and that's kept strangely in King's College in London, part of London University. And I again was able to read Harold's account. So her brother Harold, who helped dig her out of the rubble, 5 nights later St. Thomas's was hit again. Actually, it was hit one more time, and it was hit 10 times in the war, St. Thomas's. It was right over the river from the House of Parliament, so it was kind of an obvious target. And so Ruth was buried on the first night but dug out alive, and the second night, it was hit, the 13th of September, nobody was killed. But the third night was the third hit was the worst, the 15th of September, and Harold, who was a medical student, was walking down a corridor in the basement with his great friend, a chap called Peter Spilsbury, and a bomb hit, pretty much where he was walking, straight ahead, above him. And Peter Spilsbury was killed outright, right next to him, and they were in, you know, mid-conversation. Harold and Peter Spilsbury's head was apparently taken straight off by flying rubble, or a piece of metal. And Harold was hit in the head, and along with several others, he was buried under the rubble. And the fire brigade were there very quickly and had their hoses on. And the whole hospital was, you know, filled with gas. And the pharmacy, all the spirits in the pharmacy had caught fire. And it was just this awful apocalyptic, you know, scene. And the rescue teams were trying to dig people out and tunnelling under the rubble. And the air raid was still going on overhead, so they had to kind of dim their torches every time a plane came over. And they sort of did a head count and realised that several doctors were missing, including Harold, and they found Peter Spilsbury's body. And then after one of the doctors, one of his friends had tunnelled, you know, at huge risk to himself, tunnelled under the rubble, they found Harold and they realised that he was still alive. He was unconscious, but they managed to get him out, and he was in a coma, and he was taken to a hospital in Woking because the London hospitals outsourced as much as they could to outside London for, you know, to keep them away from the air raids. So he was taken to be treated by a neurologist in Woking, and Ruth was summoned and told, look, your brother, he's very badly injured. If he survives, he's going to be brain damaged. If I were you, I'd hope he dies. But actually, after 5 days, he came out of his coma and he was perfectly fine. So I was able to read his account of that night in the journal. I mean, he didn't remember anything between his conversation with his mate Peter and then waking up in Woking Hospital. His rescuers that night, several of whom were awarded the George Medal, would that be? They'd also written accounts. And an amazing thing happened a few months ago. A lady in our village who'd read my book got in touch and said, I've got somebody staying with me who is the granddaughter of the chap who rescued your great uncle, Harold.
No.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
That was amazing. So I was able to put her in touch. She was visiting from, I can't remember where she's visiting from, but I was able to put her in touch with my cousin Pam, Harold's, one of Harold's daughters, and after all this pandemic business is over, they're going to get together and meet. Yeah, so that's really nice.
So it really is sort of detective work, isn't it? It's sort of piecing bits together and following little kind of clues and until their conclusion. And
you have to hope that somewhere someone in your family is a hoarder, because actually really late in the day, my cousin Nick, who's the eldest son of the eldest of the six siblings, Edward, his wife, who's called Maybe, is a terrific family archivist, and she found all these letters that Edward had written during the war and before and during the war. Actually, that was absolutely brilliant, because I could just fill in, you know, lots of gaps through that and just get a flavour of also the rivalry between the two brothers, Edward and Walter, who were both, you know, sort of young, ambitious army officers, and both ended up commanding their battalions at the same time. Edward on the Gothic line in Italy and Walter in Burma. And Edward was quite a prolific letter writer back to his parents. He wrote in, I think it was May 1945, and he'd just been told he'd been awarded the DSO. And so he wrote back to his parents saying, you know, been given the DSO. And then a few months later, he writes back saying, oh, Walter's got the DSO too, I hear.
and Annabelle, as battalion commanders, how old are they at this point?
Walter was about 32. And Edward was, he was a couple of years older, but he was sort of 35.
Pretty young, though, still, to be a battalion commander by today's standards.
Yeah, and you know what they had to do, you know, just reading about, it's just so relentless, isn't it? You know, there's no let up. You're being shelled all the time, and you know, on the Gothic line, just going to, so there's a one of the things I found in the regimental diary, which sort of had nobody in the family told me about, and Edward obviously never mentioned it, but right at the end of the fighting in Italy, when the Germans are just on the point of surrendering, but they've sown the whole countryside more or less with mines. And he goes for a meeting with another battalion commander, you know, a couple of miles away, to discuss attack that they're going to do together the next day. And the battalion diary, literally in sort of two lines, says on the way back, CO blown into the air by a mine. So you don't, you know, trodden pretty much not on top of, but very close to a mine, which had burn him in the air and, you know, knocked him out for a bit, but then he got up and carried on. And he was fine. But, you know, that happened. And, you know, my very similar thing, probably within the same week to Walter in Burma, you know, at the Battle of Tong Dor, he's directing things from sort of just over the ridge. And he's got his radio set on his mule. And as he puts he's just given his last set of instructions, puts the receiver back, jumps over a ditch, and in that instant, the mule handler and the radio set are all blown up. He missed it by a second, 2 seconds.
Absolutely amazing. Because, I mean, yeah, the incredible thing about it is that all six survived, don't they?
Such close calls. You know, Peter came very close to death on the death railway. And at the end of the war, when Walter is sent to Thailand to help round up the Japanese there who had surrendered, but the ones in Thailand who hadn't been defeated in battle really didn't think they had surrendered, so that was quite a tough job, and he wanted to find out what happened to Peter, because there was practically no communication, you know, the letter, there was not much in the way of a postal service between the camp. It was very different to the prisoner of war camps in Germany and so on, that, you know, getting letters to and from prisoner of war camps, the Japanese didn't have much of a postal service going. I think my great-grandparents got one notification that Peter was alive at some point in 1943 and another in 1944, but then they didn't hear anything more.
Just imagine.
So, you know, I do feel for my great-aunt, my great-grandmother, Dorothea. She was a bit of a battle axe, but she and Arthur, my great-grandfather, you know, what a war, you know, one minute they...
What a lot of worrying. I mean...
What a lot of worrying. You know, Ruth just survived a hit. Then she rings up to say, Harold's been, you know, hit. He's going to be fine. Not that she knew that, but she said that he was, you know, Edward right in the thick of it, Walter right in the thick of it, Peter, they didn't know whether he was alive or dead. So, you know, absolutely
amazing. I mean, it's incredible that they all came back. It really is absolutely extraordinary. The most extraordinary story. I mean, I loved your book, as you know. It was just fantastic. I mean, a lot of people say, you know, I want to track down my uncle or my grandfather or whatever, and you know, where do I start? And fortunately, the Luftwaffe didn't destroy the records for the Second World War, so because obviously they were still in the process of being made. So Second World War records, military records, are still around, and you can get those, but they're not open to the public at the moment. But if you're a family member, you can ask for them. So the way to do that is to go onto the Ministry of Defence website, and you can apply for it. And we'll put up the web links on Facebook and stuff, but it's very easy to find. I mean, obviously right now, you know, searching for people's personal military records, from the past is not a top priority for the MOD, but once COVID's over and done with, I mean, you know, everyone should do it because it's a pretty good service. And as a family member, you have a right to call that military record, and there it is, you know, and that gives you your start point, because it gives you the service number, it gives you where they
exactly.
were at a particular date,
it'll give you the dates,
the units, and then you can start to build a picture around that, you know, by looking at kind of battalion war diaries or whatever it might be.
The battalion war diaries are great. And the other thing, my other sort of real tip, is read around as widely as you can. So when Ruth was still alive, you know, the more I read of what was happening in London in 1940, then I could ask her, oh, what about that? Oh, well Dunkirk was going on. Were you involved in Dunkirk? And she'd say, and you know, she'd never mentioned before, oh, yes, you know, I nursed the people coming back from Dunkirk and, you know, had to hold them as they were dying. And, you know, until you read a lot, you don't know the right questions to ask.
Yeah.
So well, that was...
I mean, this has made me want to have a... Because I know a little bit about... I know about one of my mother's father, but I don't know about her uncle, who's in the Gloucesters, and killed in Burma in 1944. And I mean, if you put Gloucester Regiment Burma into Google, which I've just done now, it takes you to a World War II officer's died thing. I put his surname in, and there he is, straight through to find him. In fact, when was he killed? Anyway, there it is. You know, you can do it that quickly and easily, that actually this information is out there. People are compiling it and putting it on the internet, which I think is really interesting.
Yes, and there's lots of people. So Facebook was great. You know, there are things like the Far East Prisoner of War Facebook group. You know, there's people, amazing people, just volunteers, putting together prisoner of war records, putting them up online. There's also the Thai Burma Railway Centre in Thailand, where they are, you know, archiving every bit of information from the camps on the death railway. And if you ask them about your uncle or grandfather or whoever, they will come back with his records. You know, there are incredible people out there, a lot of them just, you know, volunteers and enthusiasts.
Yes, doing it for the sake of it, really.
Yeah.
I mean, it is very interesting, actually, how a vast amount of this is kept going by enthusiasts. These things exist. These sort of, you know, this sort of organic curation of the history exists. And people know, I think people need to understand that if you, you know, you can kind of throw the pebble into the internet, the pool, and you get lots of ripples back.
It's amazing. And you do end up down some rabbit holes, but some really wonderful holes.
But you can, but people can sort of get the ball rolling from during lockdown. And I mean, I suppose the message is you know, don't expect to have, you know, family history that's quite as exciting as yours, Annabelle. But
well, it's amazing what you turn up. Yeah, and actually, loads of people got in touch after, you know, reading my book and said, oh, you know, you've prompted me to look into my history, and they've found incredible stories. You know, that's the wonderful thing I found with writing my book, is how many ordinary people did extraordinary things in the war. I mean, you know,
but if you don't look after your own family, then you know, within a few generations they're forgotten. They're just absolute toast. You know, if you want your family story to continue, then actually it's really, really worth doing this.
Yes, totally. You know, and even if you only just get down a few details, so Ruth was given this book called A Grandparent Story, and it's quite a sort of trite, I suppose, basic little journal, but it said, you know, where were you born, what school did you go to, who was your best friend, who was your favourite brother, you know, what did you want to do when you're older, and she just kind of wrote to, you know, a couple of words on each thing, but it was, you know, really helpful because, you know, then I knew that Peter was the naughtiest brother and her favourite, and Walter always bossed her around and made her warm the loo seat up for him.
Well, you discover what and that's what families are like, aren't they? And so you again, it's this thing that they come into colour out of sort of a black and white image, don't they?
And they become
people rather than people in the past.
Yeah, and for me that was great because, you know, some of my great uncles I'd never met, so getting to know them through talking to their children and through the letters and so on was fantastic. And somebody who got in touch said that they'd been prompted to get their children to do a sort of desert island discs on their grandparents and record, you know, their grandparents talking about their lives. And I thought that was just a fantastic idea. So, you know, anything like that is...
Well, thank you so much for talking to us and taking us, I mean, not just through your family's history, but how we all find out about our family's histories.
Well, thank you very much.
Really, really fascinating, Annabelle. And again, it makes you think, right, well, what can I, like James says, there's lots you can find out without getting up off your arse. And seeing as we're not allowed to get up off our arses at the moment, no one has any excuse but to go and find this stuff out.
Exactly.
Exactly.
Yeah. And it's just so much fun, you know, nicer way to spend your time than...
This, what's not to like? Is that what we say, James?
Yeah, it is. WNTL. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. Ladies and gentlemen, Annabelle Venning, thanks for listening.
Thank you.
Cheerio.
Thanks again to Annabelle for that fascinating insight into her family and also for sharing her tips on how to research your own family history. As we mentioned during the chat, this is the start of a new weekend series devoted to telling the family stories of our listeners during the Second World War. The plan is that we'll release a show each Sunday morning in which James and I read out your family stories. We've already had lots of these stories sent to us and they're genuinely fascinating. They really underline how the war touched everyone's family one way or another. But now we want to share them with you, the We Have Ways community. If you'd like to share your family story, please send it to the team here at We Have Ways. Anything from 50 words up to a maximum of 500 if you've got an absolute belter. You can email us at wehavewayspodcast@gmail.com. Please do make the subject of the email family stories so we don't miss it. That email address, once again, wehavewayspodcast@gmail.com. Or if you are an independent company member on Patreon, we do already have a family stories tab there, which has a big thread ongoing. And we're going to start to mine that seam. Just leave your story there and we'll check them regularly. We hope you enjoy this upcoming series. We are really looking forward to reading your stories and sharing them with the rest of the We Have Ways gang. Thank you.